from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. UCSF Medicine Department Chief Dr. Robert Wachter has been busy on social media since the outbreak began. He thinks it's vital to keep the public informed and up to date on the newest data and on the number of hospitalized with coronavirus, and also to call out misinformation and rumor. Coming up, Dr. Wachter joins us to answer your questions about the novel coronavirus. We'll also talk with him about the tension between flattening the curve and the public health costs of an economic downturn, and when we might be able to get back to a new normal. That's next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. At a press conference yesterday, Governor Newsom said California is preparing for a mid-May peak of COVID-19 infections in the state. At the same time, there are signs that the Bay Area is flattening the curve. And UCSF Department of Medicine Chair Bob Wachter joins us now to talk about how Newsom's prognosis fits with what we're seeing in the Bay Area. And we're also going to talk with him about the public health benefits and costs of sheltering in place and how virtual doctor visits or telemedicine is helping to fight the novel coronavirus. And welcome back to Forum. Bob Wachter, good to have you.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Under the circumstances, I keep thinking about you writing on Twitter that you're eating comfort food, and I'm glad that in this pandemic and with all the adversity we're facing that you're having your SpaghettiOs and Oreos. I know you're also tracking numbers, and I want to talk with you about that because we just topped 10,000 deaths, and that is hideous and certainly very difficult to process. But there's some good news on the horizon. The lead story, in fact, in NPR, which our listeners just heard, was that the numbers seem to be down in hospitalizations in New York. And there's some at least feeling, perhaps, of guarded optimism here in the Bay Area. I want to get your sense of the numbers, and because just a slower pace than last week in terms of cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to talk about good news in where we find ourselves. There are people who are dying all over the world. It's a remarkable time. None of us have ever seen anything like this before. The economic impact is profound. So there's nothing good about any of this. But in terms of signs of optimism and signs that things may be turning around, they are there. It's looking like most of the parts of the United States that have been hard hit appear to be nearing their peak, and that means there's a lot of terrible things still to come because the peaks are very high. But the projections for New York are that New York will peak in the next few days and then will begin coming down. The experience here in the Bay Area has been remarkable. We were preparing to be New York. When I started tweeting about this 3 weeks ago, it was the number of cases in San Francisco and New York was essentially the same. And so I thought I sort of had a front seat view to something that was going to be extraordinary, and I thought extraordinarily terrible. And what we've seen has not been that. We have seen in all of San Francisco, we've seen about 600 cases. We've had 9 deaths in San Francisco. That's all tragic and terrible. And yet the projections that we had been dealing with 3 weeks ago were going to be 10 times that, if not more, overwhelming the healthcare systems. It's not what we've seen at UCSF today. We have a total, I haven't heard today's numbers yet, but yesterday we had 19 patients in the hospital and about 7 or 8 in the intensive care unit, about 5 on mechanical ventilators. So terrible for those patients and their families, but in terms of what we were gearing ourselves up for, orders of magnitude less than we'd feared.
Well, a lot of plaudits and kudos go out to Bay Area residents who have been sheltering in space and in place, and that's created a great deal of adversity, but there's been an extraordinary response, and I think we need to highlight that. But I'm also wanting to highlight with you this new analysis out of the University of Washington, which says April 14th on the epidemic breaking in California. That's sooner than the estimates that are coming out of state officials, and they're sticking with mid-May on this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know where they're getting the mid-May numbers. They've got world-class epidemiologists, and you can put in different data and get different outcomes. The data that I've been looking at, I think to many of us looks like the most rigorous analysis is the University of Washington's analysis that shows that at least for California, it appears that we're going to peak in mid-April. Now, our course, we have really flattened the curve. You know, we've all become very familiar with that very big peak and rapid descent that they're seeing in New York, and the alternative was that flat curve. That's what we're seeing. And what that means is that there isn't a peak as in a roller coaster ride. It is a flatter peak. So it's possible that what they're looking at the state level is that we may reach something near a peak in the next few weeks, and we may kind of teeter there for a while without, and then a slow descent. That is what the flat curve looks like. But whether it's in a couple of weeks or 4 weeks, I think the message is probably the same, that at least it looks like we have dodged the worst of it. And if you look at New York, you see what the worst of it looks like. It's quite terrible. That does not mean that it's time to go out and party and it's safe to go back to our old habits. It means that we've got to continue hunkering down for at least several weeks. And then at some point, the peak comes down and you get down to a level of virus in the community that makes it acceptable to begin resuming some of your former activities. And I'm sure we'll get to it. But what that looks like is kind of tricky, because it is not that you go back and everything is normal. There still is virus in the community. The vast, vast majority of us have not been exposed to it, will not be immune to it. It's not even clear yet what immunity means. And so as we move into a second phase of this, which I believe will be sometime in the next 4, 6, 8 weeks, it's going to be far more nuanced than where we are now. Now it's pretty straightforward. It's stay at home, 6 feet away, cover your face, clean your hands. There's not a lot of subtlety to that messaging. The messaging as we go forward may be much more nuanced, that some people can begin resuming going back to work, that people at higher risk of bad outcomes from COVID maybe can't, that maybe we're checking people's antibodies, and if you do appear to be immune, you have a little bit more freedom than if you're not. It's going to be tricky, and it's going to be pretty nuanced trying to sort all that out.
It's very nuanced. It's also ironic that the places where the virus is surging, it often gets terrible abruptly and then gets better fast. But I wanted to ask you just how prepared we are continuing. Governor Newsom also has asked for 50,000 more hospital beds. We now have 75,000. And I know that Director of Public Health in San Francisco, Grant Colfax, is talking about 253 more ICU hospital beds. I'm wondering just about the number of hospital beds that we have from your perspective. I know there's been a lot of changes that have gone on, the new kind of triages we're going through because of the coronavirus. But are we prepared to really see this out?
Well, I think we are, and I think at this moment, anything can change, and, you know, we've been watching our nursing homes very carefully. We're watching to see whether people hear the relative good news and begin changing the behavior in ways that can be dangerous. But assuming that we keep the trajectory we've been on, at least what we're seeing in San Francisco is that the hospital beds have been adequate, the ICUs have been adequate, the doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists and others who are taking care of these patients have been adequate. We've done some preparation for the possibility of a surge, and in a wonderful act of cooperation, all of the hospitals in San Francisco came together to help reopen a unused unit at St. Francis. At UCSF, we're reopening Mount Zion Hospital, which we'd closed as an inpatient facility. So we've all built additional capacity.
Absolutely. Reopening California Pacific, too, I think, right?
Yes, some of the Cal Pacific facilities that had been closed down. So I think we're all gearing up and have geared up for the surge that we thought would be coming. It would have been completely imprudent not to do that. But at least so far, it feels like we're standing on the beach waiting for the tsunami, and we're seeing waves, but they're kind of up to our knees or maybe up to our thighs. And at least everything that I'm seeing here in the Bay Area is that we are not going to see the kind of overwhelming surge that they're seeing in New York, and we should be okay. It's leading to a number of interesting and challenging decisions. At UCSF, for example, we stopped doing anything other than the most emergent surgery, meaning that if you don't have surgery today, there's a good chance you will die. Now we're rethinking that, and we're beginning to look at patients that need their surgery, like you have a cancer and it needs to come out. It didn't happen have to happen 3 weeks ago, but at some point soon it has to. And so we're trying to carefully calibrate that. We've got a prioritized list of the patients most in need of surgery and other procedures, and we're beginning to call some of those patients back in, obviously watching our COVID numbers every day. And if we do see something resembling a surge, we'll close that back down. We're beginning to send some of our PPE, which we were frantically worried about, the protective equipment 3 weeks ago. We're beginning to send some of it to other hospitals in California if we don't need it. And we're beginning to think about sending some of it to New York. I've got a number of people in my department who are saying, you know, could we go to more harder hit places? And we're not ready to pull the trigger on that, but we're certainly looking at it, because if we have been lucky on this, there are certainly other parts of the country that have not been. And I think, you know, our instinct is to be as generous as we can be to try to help as many people as we can.
We're talking to Dr. Bob Wachter. He is chair of the Department of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and also author of a book, which we talked about on forum, called The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. And you've been following, I believe, University of Washington model in terms of what you're doing with COVID-19. But what about the testing? You're doing about 300, 400 testing a day, I believe, but sending people home who had mild symptoms, is that going to change?
I think it needs to change, but I think about testing in two different ways, and this gets confusing to people. At UCSF today, we now have all the tests that we need to test people with symptoms. That was not true 3 weeks ago, which was another point of franticness. But we rapidly ramped up our test capacity, actually with the help of the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, which is a research facility, but converted themselves into a clinical testing facility. So we can do all the tests we need for patients who have symptoms. And again, because the Bay Area has been relatively light, we have not been overwhelmed. That's one kind of testing, because we really need to know that. Someone who comes to the emergency room with a fever and a cough, we need to know whether they have COVID. Now, it turns out they all think they do. It's quite logical to think that they do. In our testing of patients with symptoms that could be COVID, fever, cough, shortness of breath, about 5% of them are positive, meaning that 19 out of 20 people that we have seen with symptoms that could be COVID have turned out not to have it. There's a lot of other viral illnesses around, and if you have those symptoms, it could be, but at least in our testing of several thousand people, the majority don't. There's another kind of testing that when people talk about the shortage of testing, it's really testing for epidemiology and case-finding purposes, meaning right now, if you don't have enough tests and someone has fairly mild symptoms, and there's really no treatment for COVID yet, at least that we know for sure works. Obviously, we can get into that later. But we tell people to go stay home and quarantine themselves. It seems like a prudent thing to do, and the test really wouldn't change anything. But as we move toward a new phase of this, if we can tamp down this virus to the point that there are very, very few cases in our community, and we're beginning to open back up, we're beginning to resume some of our normal behaviors, we need an aggressive testing strategy. So if someone even has very mild symptoms in the community, we want them to be able to get a drive-by test. We want it to be back quickly. We want to know if they have it. We want to then go out and figure out, if they do have it, who they've been in contact with for the last several days. We want to go ahead and test them. My analogy here is that of a wildfire, that the phase we were in a few weeks ago, the phase they're still in New York, is there's a wildfire burning. You've got to just do everything you can to get it, to douse it. That we're going to enter a phase where the wildfire, the big part of it is out, but there are still little embers that pop up periodically. And if you don't find them and really trounce on them, then they can spread back into another wildfire. So that's where we need much more widespread testing and contact tracing going forward.
Again, we're talking to Dr. Bob Wachter, and let me invite you to join us. I have some other things I wanted to bring up with you, Bob. I wanted to talk about telemedicine somewhat, but also about plasma. But let me invite our listeners, who I know have many questions. And in fact, you can join us now at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Join us live at 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. I said something about plasma, and I'm looking at a question from a listener who says, what will the role of antibody tests be? And I mentioned plasma because it's a pretty rich source for antibodies, it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, the way this all works, I think people have gotten a sense of it, is you get the infection, and the infection then is a battle between your body's antibodies and the bug itself and the virus itself. And for the vast majority of people, your own antibodies win and ultimately prove victorious over the virus. You then have antibodies in your bloodstream. So it brings up a few different questions. One is, are you immune? Can you get reinfected with the virus? And the answer is probably not, but we don't know for 100% certainty yet. It's a subject of active research. A second question that comes up is, if you are immune, how long does the immunity last for? Another question we don't know the answer to. There are certain infections where you're immune for life. Other infections, the immunity lasts for a year or two and then wanes. That might be okay if by the time your immunity goes away, we have a vaccine. The third question that comes up is, if I have had the infection, I have antibodies, and somebody then takes my plasma and distills out the antibodies and injects it into another patient, will it either prevent the infection or will it make the infection more mild if they have it? And there was a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association last week of five patients who received that, what's called convalescent plasma, who appeared to do better. Now, it just shows the depth of the concern here, that in the old days, if you sent a paper to JAMA, one of our most prominent medical journals, with a story of five patients, they would have laughed at you. And this got published pretty much the next day because everybody's so desperate for solutions. So I'd say that looks promising, and it definitely needs to be tested, and we are engaged in some studies to test it as well. I would not say that it's proven to work yet.
Another quick question from a listener on testing. Suzanne writes, a relative is sick with symptoms of COVID-19, but his test came back negative, and they won't give him a second test, and have said that if he's feeling better at the end of the week, he can go back to work. I'm concerned he could be spreading it in the community. What are the incidents of false negatives, and shouldn't we retest if someone is symptomatic?
Yeah, so these are all hard questions. If we had unlimited testing, the answer might be yes, but we still have limited testing. I mean, to the incidence of false negatives is not zero. There are some people that will have a negative test and ultimately, if you tested them again, might be positive. If their test is negative, the chances are their level of virus is low. They probably not very contagious. But I think the most important fact is, sort of reiterate what I said before, the prevalence of COVID in our community here in the Bay Area is quite low. We now have had enough widespread testing to know that there are just not a lot of cases out there lurking. Again, for people that have come to UCSF with symptoms, who we've tested, about 1 in 20 are positive. So that person who had, quote, symptoms of COVID, the overwhelming odds, 19 out of 20 chance, is they did not have COVID. If their test is negative, I think the odds that they have it and it was a false negative are vanishingly small. And I think if they're feeling better and their test was negative, I think at this point it is safe to say that they don't have it, they're not capable of transmitting it, and that they should be able to do whatever it is that we're all doing. I mean, we're still in shelter in place. We're still all being very careful. But I think you would have to declare that person as probably never having had it in the first place.
Now let me bring a caller on with us. Sasha joins us. Sasha, good morning.
Yes, hi. Are you there?
We're here.
Hi. Yes. I'm calling because I have rheumatoid arthritis that I've had for at least 10 years, and I did try to call in my prescription of hydroxychloroquine, which I've known for years as Plaquenil, and I was told that I can't get it, that there's a worldwide shortage, and that I have to talk to my doctor about an alternative. So it's just a kind of concerning feeling.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm sorry you're going through that. Of course, the hydroxychloroquine story is...
It's an ongoing saga, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Basically, hydroxychloroquine is an old medicine. It's been around for decades. It is used for patients with some rheumatologic diseases, including the one Sasha has.
Bob, excuse me, it's mainly an anti-malarial drug, isn't it, to a great degree?
It was founded as a, you know, in the old days you gave people quinine, and this is a derivative of it, and that's what it was built for. But it was found to be effective in certain patients with what are known as autoimmune diseases, diseases where your body is attacking itself, and rheumatoid arthritis is one of them. And it's quite effective for certain patients with those diseases. It's often known as a steroid-sparing drug, meaning if you didn't have it, you would have to take higher doses of medicines like prednisone, which are more dangerous. And so for many people, it's life-saving, or at least allows them to retain their function. The study that has led to some enthusiasm about the possibility that hydroxychloroquine will work in patients with COVID comes out of France. It was a poorly done study. The results are unimpressive, and the journal that published it just yesterday sort of retracted the paper. As they said, as we looked at the methods of the study, we're no longer confident that the results are real. How that then leads to the President of the United States touting this as a cure and that everybody should be on it and that we're going to stockpile the drug is anybody's guess. It makes absolutely no sense to me. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous for two reasons. One is the reason that Sasha articulates, which is there are patients in whom it has been absolutely proven to be beneficial. And if they can't get it because of this, that's scary and pretty terrible. The second is the drug is not benign. The drug has, at least can have, some significant side effects, particularly cardiac side effects. You heard about the case in Arizona, where the husband and wife took a version of it and one of them died. This is not nothing. And for the president to be out there saying, you know, I have a gut feeling that it works, and to say, what do you have to lose? It's shocking. And
the president is its biggest booster, without question. But I'm wondering, what about these cases? There are a couple of them, and they're certainly in some ways scarce, to be sure, but where people have actually had some amelioration of symptoms with coronavirus as a result of that drug.
Well, this is why we do randomized trials. So if you take 100 people with coronavirus, 99 of them will recover. 80 of them will recover and never need to go to the hospital. As I said, a fair number of the people who think they have coronavirus don't if you actually test them. The people that are sick enough to be in the hospital, most of them will get well enough to leave. And if you give them a medicine and say, here is this medicine, take it, they all feel like the medicine cured them. That's logical. It's normal. It just is wrong. And so this is why we test medicines in a rigorous way, why the FDA exists to say this sounds like a good idea, but there are a whole lot of things in the history of medicine that sounded like a good idea and turned out not to work or actually turned out to be harmful. And this is one of them that requires that kind of testing.
And we will continue with Dr. Bob Wachter. He's chair of the Department of Medicine, UCSF. And we'll take more of your calls when we return and read more of your emails and get some answers from the doctor who is good enough to be with us this hour. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dr. Bob Wachter. He's chair of the Department of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco, also author of a book called The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. Telemedicine has changed a great deal because of essentially what we've been going through here. And I want to find out, Bob, your thoughts about where we are. It certainly has made triage a whole different meaning for many who are practicing medicine and for the hospitals throughout, well, the world, I suppose. It's saying, and some are saying, its moment has arrived. The telemedicine, its moment has arrived because of triage with coronavirus. But the healthcare system, and particularly reimbursement, sort of go against this idea that we can do everything by telemedicine now, or we should be doing everything by telemedicine. Like your thoughts.
Well, I've been a fan of telemedicine for years. It seems logical to me that that for many of the things that we do that don't require a lot of hands-on and physical examination, that we could do them well by telemedicine and save people the the hassle of having to drive and park and come up and all that for a 15-minute visit. And so at UCSF, we've been working on it for several years, and we've developed a pretty good telemedicine capacity. But frankly, I think a lot of doctors were a little reluctant to try it. They were trained in the traditional way. I think a lot of patients were reluctant. And so until a month ago, about 2% of our outpatient visits at UCSF were done via telemedicine. That number is up to 60% today. Because we really do not want people to come in, and most people, and we want people to be staying at home, which is what they should be doing. So I don't know that it's going to stay at 60% when we're done with this, but it's never going back to 2% again. And some of the obstacles that previously got in the way, like the technology being good enough, the technology's improved drastically. Some of the reimbursement policies have gotten in the way, and those have been lightened. Those have been made easier during this pandemic, and I'm hoping that it'll stay that way. There's some silly rules like you have to be licensed in every state that you're practicing in that have gotten in the way of telemedicine. There's no reason that if a patient from Oregon or Nevada wants to see a UCSF doctor by telemedicine, that doctor is going to have to go get his or her license in that state. And that rule has been relaxed. So I'm hoping that this is not a temporary blip, and I think it won't be. I think patients, once they experience, realize it, that this is pretty nice, and the idea, 10 years from now, the idea that I took half a day off from work to go see the doctor for 15 minutes is going to seem silly.
A lot of video health visits, and they are escalating in number. Let me escalate the number of calls we get here. Let me go to another caller. Marty, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Good health and happy holidays to everybody.
Thank you.
Is it a certainty that a vaccine can be developed?
Well, you know, it's interesting that everybody is just holding on this 12 to 18 months that Tony Fauci talks about. And what I think they don't realize is 12 to 18 months is the minimum amount of time to develop a vaccine and test it, be sure it's safe, and be sure it works. There's no guarantee that that will be true. I'm hoping as much as anybody else, because until there is a vaccine, we're always going to be in this kind of weird place where we may have tamped down the virus to a manageable level, but we'll never be able to go back to fully normal. Think about HIV. HIV was first recognized in 1981. There is no vaccine to HIV. And so it's not a slam dunk that we're going to find one. I'm hopeful that we will. Most of the experts believe that we will. And if we do, it'll probably be in 12 to 18 months because the amount of intellectual firepower and resources going into it is unprecedented. But it is not a guarantee.
And Marty, I thank you for the call. Let me go to a listener named Leslie who says, regarding criteria for testing, how does UCSF define the term symptoms? What if the only symptom is loss of taste, which now seems to be accepted as perhaps the only symptom of someone who may be positive for COVID-19? And do we now have enough tests?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And I believe that we have added loss of taste to our list of symptoms that will get tested. It's a funny symptom that appears to be relatively distinctive. And in fact, as we look at, you know, are there any symptoms that might actually tilt us to believing that you are more likely to have COVID than other viral infections? That's one that doesn't come up in regular flu very much. So the answer is we right now have enough tests to be testing people with symptoms. And as our clinical understanding evolves, including the importance of loss of taste, we are able to expand our testing. I think the real questions are going to come up again as we reach this next phase. And in certain countries, Korea most prominently, they are doing, you know, testing at a scale far greater than the United States. A lot of asymptomatic people are tested. That's going to be tricky to do in the United States. We can't test 350 million people. Even if you test negative now, are we going to test you again in a week or two? It gets unwieldy. So we're going to reach a point where we're testing everybody with symptoms. And then for epidemiologic purposes, we may be doing some random testing of asymptomatic people, particularly at high-risk populations like in nursing homes or of healthcare workers, to get a sense of whether it's out there lurking in the community. Because we have come to understand this phenomenon of asymptomatic patients who actually have the virus. It's not incredibly prevalent, particularly in a place like the Bay Area where we're not seeing a whole lot of virus, but it certainly exists, so we have to understand it better.
Let me bring in more callers. Lisa joins us next. Lisa, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, I have two questions on testing. regarding the prevalence, about a week ago, the Chronicle reported 26% positive tests from the drive-by in Hayward sample that was not based on criteria for testing, but it was a high, that 26 was high. And secondly, regarding the 5% you see in your hospital, how are you screening out for false negatives? I understand every positive test is accurate, but the negative may be inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is sort of what the gold standard is in terms of a false negative. But the test characteristics look pretty good, that we believe that if a test is negative, that we're using that now. Since we're only testing symptomatic people, and those symptomatic people should be home and should be staying away from other people, that's what we tell them in any case. This may change some once we have more effective therapies available. We may need to retest people who are negative, who have symptoms that could be consistent with COVID. I hadn't heard the 26% figure from Hayward. I'd want to sort of look into that because it's quite surprising. There have been numbers like that in the hospitals in New York, where when people come into the emergency room who are short of breath and have a fever and have infiltrates on their chest x-ray, you know, they've had numbers like that when they test people for COVID. It's 25, 30, 40%. But that's because the virus is so prevalent in the community, it changes the probability of getting a positive test. In the Bay Area and in really all of California, the prevalence in the community is low enough that's a surprise. I don't doubt that that's true, but it's a surprising number to me. We've tested a whole lot of patients, including inpatients, patients who got admitted to the hospital with things that looked like they could be COVID disease, including pneumonia. And even in that population, we're seeing a positivity rate of about 1 in 20.
Let me thank Lisa for the call and go to a question from a listener named Chris who wants to know, given the two deadly viruses have been attributed to live animal crossovers, what are the odds of this happening again even every year? Why aren't live animal markets banned worldwide? Well, we talked about that a bit yesterday with epidemiologist Larry Brilliant, who is on the program, and they're supposed to be banned in China, but they're ongoing, and this is a ubiquitous problem. I mean, particularly out of China. Your thoughts, Bob Wachter?
Yeah, I mean, it is scary, and we are seeing something like this, if like this means a new viral infection that people are not immune to. We have been seeing something like this every 2 or 3 or 4 years, if you think about SARS and H1N1 and MERS and all of the others. The difference is that this particular virus has a set of characteristics that make it particularly nasty, and that is it combines being relatively contagious with being fairly bad. And if you have just one or the other, very contagious, but very few people die of it, or a lot of people die of it, but not very contagious, you sort of can deal with it. This one, and I think it was fairly clear in January when we saw what was happening in China, this one just by random mutations came out of the box with these two characteristics of being contagious and potentially deadly that led to where we are today. There's no good reason to think that combination will happen again. Really, the last time it happened was the Spanish flu 100 years ago. But I do believe we are likely to continue to see things like this maybe every year or two or three, which is why if we learn anything from this epidemic, we have to learn how to keep a public health infrastructure that is ready to go, how to have a pandemic plan that you pull off the shelf and push a button and enact immediately, as opposed to the halting and fragmented response that we've had for this one.
Well, we were being told by many, including Larry Brilliant, whom I just alluded to, and Bill Gates and Lori Garrett, you can go on with the list, that we need this public health infrastructure that we simply haven't been acting on. I mean, you get sort of, not to editorialize here, but you get into all of the ways we have built up our defenses to try to ward off unseen military enemies of one sort or another, and this enemy that now has come upon us should have been prepared for. There's my homily for the day.
Yeah, of course you're right, Michael. It's hard to do. It's not to forgive the stance that we've taken. We got it wrong, and we're paying the price. But It is to say that humans are not very good in preparing for theoretical problems when there are current pressing needs. So it's and the same obviously was true for 9/11 and true for climate change. It is just a hard thing for humans to get their heads around to say, let us take money and resources and attention and apply it to this problem that may never happen so that we're ready for it, as opposed to taking the money and people and dollars and spending on things that we know we need today. That's just a tricky thing to do. And you only do it, I think, certainly at the scale that you need, after you've seen the consequences of not doing it. So I think we have seen the consequences of not doing it. I think we will aggressively invest in public health and preparedness for the future. But, you know, it would have been nice had we done it in the past, and certainly there have been smart people telling us we better do it, and we'll be sorry if we didn't, and they were right.
And we'll go to another caller. That's Grace from Palo Alto joining us. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, and thanks for your time. I am 78, and I have a high-risk condition, hypertension plus age. I rent out rooms in my house. One of the persons works for Instagram. The other person is an LVN or works in the health field. And I've been sharing kitchen, and I'm just not quite sure the best way to manage it. It sounds like we don't have the high risk that, of course, New York has. So I guess I need some advice.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, people should stay as isolated as they can. I mean, you know, it's hard to do, and people live in different circumstances. I think the particularly if the people you're living with are not being fully isolated, if they're out in the real world and out and about, there certainly is a possibility that they can become infected, and the fact is they can be infected and not know it themselves and have no symptoms. So I would be keeping 6 foot distance from them, and if that's feasible in your place. If you're sharing a kitchen, I would be sure that anything that you touch that they have touched, you're cleaning your hands, you're cleaning the surfaces. I think that's the best that you can do. I wouldn't be running around super scared about it, but I think that until this thing is tamped down to a rate in the Bay Area that's essentially zero, I think that's the prudent thing to do. Now, if both of them or the other people who are living with you have been on full quarantine for a couple of weeks, have not been out in the real world and are being super careful, then you could probably be a little bit less aggressive. But my son lives just beneath us, and he's not out very much, but I make him dinner and I hand it to him in the backyard every night, and trying to be careful to keep our distance. I'm over 60, so I'm in an at-risk group as well.
Be careful, Grace. That's the message from Dr. Wachter, and thank you for the call. I'm wondering if you could say something, Bob, about the fact that people are wondering, when is the curve down enough to go back to semblance of normality?
Yeah, it's a really hard question, Michael. I think the answer, there are a lot of experts sort of looking at that, and there are going to be recommendations about that. The best one, if you have a chance to have Scott Gottlieb on, who the former FDA commissioner, he's put out a white paper on exactly that question. It seems to be that if the rate of new infections in a region goes down to close to zero, the curve is clearly downtrending and gets close to zero and has stayed that way for a couple of weeks. So you're sure there isn't, because the thing about this virus is what you're seeing today reflects what happened 2 weeks ago. That's why we weren't comfortable at UCSF or in San Francisco that we had dodged the worst of the bullet until 2 weeks after the shelter in place, because everything is already baked in from that time. So you really want to wait a couple of weeks after your rates are very, very low, and then begin to open back up. And you have to do it. You know, we have to recognize that there are real costs, including health costs, but certainly economic costs to our current posture. And then how you do it is going to be, as I said, quite nuanced. It probably is, you know, you begin to expand the idea of what an essential business is to allow more things to open. You continue to have people sit far apart from each other. So, for example, if you open restaurants, you change the way you do seating. I think the mask policy is going to stay for a while. It's not clear exactly how long, but certainly for me, even if there were relatively few cases in the Bay Area, at least for the foreseeable future, when I go to the Safeway, I'm wearing a mask. So I think it's not going to be normal as we define normal until we get down to zero cases and we have probably we have a vaccine around. So we're talking about a year and a half of this kind of strange life that we've all are unfortunately becoming used to.
All right, let me go to a caller here. Mark is next. Mark, you're on. Morning.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that the whole shutdown seems to have been a disaster in so many ways. Would it not have been a better plan to get PPE, you know, masks and gloves on everybody to accomplish the same distancing as well?
Bob Wachter?
Yeah, I think I understood the question, which is the shutdown has been a disaster, and it certainly has been a disaster economically. Would it have been a better idea to get PPE on everybody? The answer is no, and the reason is as recently as 1 week ago, so for the first several weeks of this, we didn't have enough PPE to go around our hospital. And so, the idea that we would have had enough PPE to go around to deal with 3 or 4 million people in the Bay Area or 350 million people in the United States is an impossibility. We couldn't guarantee that a doctor who was intubating a patient in the ICU would have enough PPE to keep him or herself safe. So it just was not feasible. It wouldn't have worked very well either. It just turns out the PPE certainly works better than nothing, and we all need to wear it, but trying to outfit 350 million people with PPE, get them to wear it correctly all the time and go out and about and do their activities, that's infeasible. And so we did what we absolutely had to do, and it's incredibly sad when you look at what it's done to the economy, but it's better than what the alternative would have been, which would have been several million deaths in the United States.
And let me thank you, Mark, for the call. Karen, let me go to an email here from Amy, who says, I just did my first video visit with my doc, and my insurance could not tell me if the visit would be covered. And I've read the Zoom privacy policy, and I'm alarmed that the doctor chooses to use it. I did a whole program on Zoom yesterday, and there were a lot of questions about certainly privacy there. But what about the concerns that she's raising here? Your thoughts, Bob Wachter?
Yeah, the insurance policies are evolving quickly because this caught them as surprised as everybody else. Most of the insurers are now covering televisits as being essentially equivalent to in-person visits. I think the pressure on them to do that and essentially equalize a televisit to a regular in-person visit is going to be tremendous. So I don't think we're going to go back. I'm sure there's going to be some bumpiness for the next few months as they all sort out their policies. In terms of privacy, the system that we use at UCSF, we spend a lot of time and energy making sure that it's as private as it can be, but that has to continuously be ramped up as the bad guys and gals have figured out how to hack into Zoom as they have done everywhere else. The problem is we might say, oh, I'm scared of using it because of privacy, but at this point today, I'd be more scared of going out and about than using telemedicine if you need to talk to your doctor. So we got to make it better, and we have to make the insurance rules have to be clearer. But I think this is a reasonable way of substituting for an in-person visit, and I think it's going to be so convenient for both doctors and patients that I think it's never going to go away again.
Our next caller is joining us from Portland, Oregon. Joseph, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you. Great show. Regarding pre-existing conditions, my understanding is with high blood pressure and diabetes, I think blood pressure now with the new guidelines is what, 40% of Americans has it, diabetes, 1 in 3 Americans. If we're saying these are pre-existing conditions and the mortality rate is 1.5% or so, which is awful, obviously, if these conditions were really that bad, wouldn't we have a higher mortality rate? So are we making people more fearful who might have those conditions? And lastly, if you have those conditions under control with medications, are you better protected? And why isn't there public service announcements, telling people to make sure that if you do have these conditions to make sure you take your meds and, take care of yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is clear that there are a number of factors that worsen outcomes with COVID. By the way, they don't necessarily mean you're more likely to get it. They just mean that if you do get it, you're more likely to have bad outcomes. And the most dominant one in all the studies is older age. So 80 is worse than 70, 70 is worse than 60. Things begin to flatten out below 60, although we certainly have seen terrible things happen in 20 and 30-year-olds. So no one is immune from a bad outcome. If you take two 70-year-olds and one has diabetes and one doesn't, the person with diabetes has a somewhat higher chance of having worse outcomes. Still, overall, the chances, the mortality rates never get above 10% or so, which doesn't sound all that reassuring, but it's not like if you get it, there's a super high chance that you're going to die of it, but it is riskier if you have a pre-existing disease like that. It certainly seems prudent to try to keep your blood pressure and your diabetes and obesity, the things that seem to be risk factors, under control. It's not been proven that that would make a difference, although it seems logical to me that it would. Why wouldn't it make a profound difference? In part because if you have long-standing diabetes or high blood pressure, and it has not been under control in the past, that's probably done some damage to your organs that may be part of what explains a worse prognosis. But every reason in the world to try to keep those things under control, it's not to scare people, but they do make the prognosis a little bit worse than if you were the same age and didn't have them.
Another listener question. Listener writes, I know that the virus stays pretty long on steel and plastic, but how long does it stay on our clothes? I work at a hospital, take off all my clothes and quarantine them in our garage for a day. Is that enough?
I haven't seen a study looking at clothes. I guess my closest analog is cardboard or paper, where it's been shown that it can stay for half a day to a day. And so I would imagine, there does seem to be about something, a flat, shiny surface that it can stay. There's sort of nothing to disrupt the virus, whereas a more bumpy, corrugated surface, whether it's paper or your skin or clothes, it doesn't stay as long. So to me, when we bring in the mail, we put it on the floor for a day. Clothes, I would sort of consider, if you've been in a place where you might have been exposed, I would try to put it away for a day. That would seem safe and prudent to me, but I haven't seen a study that have looked specifically about how long it can stay active on clothes.
We've got seconds left, but maybe you can give some advice to another listener named Karen, who says, what about elective surgery like hip replacement? I can barely walk due to pain, but if I have it, I need to be in skilled nursing or acute rehab for a few weeks afterward. Would that be possible soon?
I don't know. I'm sorry to hear that, but we're not doing those kinds of surgeries just yet. And it's not so much the infection rate, because we think we can do everything we can do a lot of things to make sure that people don't get infected. It is the possibility that you'd go to a skilled nursing facility. And it's also the fact that we still do not want to fill up and should not fill up our hospital with patients that don't absolutely need to be there, so that we have capacity and space in case we do see somewhat of a surge coming late. So if it were me, I would wait on that still several more weeks and then rethink it.
We will leave it there. Bob Wechter, always good to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Keep eating the comfort food and stay safe.
Always. Thanks.
Another hour of the program up ahead. Stay tuned for that. We're going to talk about the arts, and the arts are really under siege in this coronavirus. What are artists doing? That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.